Hey everyone, I'm Henrik, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com are the websites where you can follow our work on a more regular basis. I hope you've had a good September so far and that you're hungry for some hidden history. We are going to dive into the deep end today. We have with us Joseph Atwill. He's an independent scholar who has set the world of New Testament scholarship in a new direction. In his book, Caesar's Messiah, the Roman Conspiracy to Invent Jesus, Atwill has outlined a series of events in Jesus' ministry that are parallels with the events of the battle campaign of Titus Flavius, as recorded by Josephus Flavius in War of the Jews. Numerous scholars have noticed the parallels between the Gospels and Josephus' work before, but Atwill is the first to notice that all the parallels take place in exact sequence and has drawn some astonishing conclusions with this data. Joseph has been with us two times before, and I urge anyone who is new to our program or Joseph's work on typology to go into our radio archive at redicemembers.com and listen to these two previous interviews if you need some more detailed background on this. Also joining us for the first time is Ryan Gilmore. He is behind the upcoming event titled Covert Messiah: Is Christianity the Genesis of Modern Psychological Warfare? So our set goal for today, if you will, is to discuss how the imperial cult and their mind control program called Christianity has shaped our world, instigated most of the conflicts we see, and also the deeper and perhaps darker realization that this ancient war still rages today. Most people do not understand who the players are or that they are targets in this age-old revenge story. And welcome back, Joseph. It's great to talk to you again. Hope you've been well since we last spoke about a year and a half ago. Good to have you back.
It's great to be back. And yes, I've been quite well. Thank you.
Excellent. And welcome to you as well, Ryan. Thank you for being here and joining me and Joseph here today.
Hi, Heinrich.
Excellent. Now, Ryan, tell us how you got involved in some of the work that relates to Joseph's work. We have a lot to discuss here today, of course, and we're going to get into some of the arrangements of the conference and everything later. But what's your interest in this topic?
I think I started to get interested in this through Timothy Freke's work. Just in looking at alternative ways of viewing the origins of Christianity. And so just being interested in that subject on and off, eventually came across Joe's work, and I thought it was just a game-changing theory, really.
Very good. Now, how did you progress from that to the point of where we are today to arrange a conference about it and everything else? You're going to bring in Ken Humphries as well that we've had on the program before?
Yes, Ken's coming. So, I believe I wrote Joe through his blog, one of his blog posts, and we started talking, started Skyping, and I think we became fast friends. It's I think Joe is just so insightful on this topic.
Indeed, I agree. Of course, we've talked about Caesar's Messiah in the past, or Flavian's signature, Joseph. And you do have a new book coming out here called The Single Strand. This is a sequel to Caesar's Messiah. What direction do you go in this new one, Joseph?
it's a book that's almost impossible to describe, probably impossible to read. It traces the typology that is found in the Gospels and even before the Gospels and the Dead Sea Scrolls, which the Gospels are in fact a reaction to. And you go forward in time through the Pauline material in the Book of Revelation. And I show how that literature is easy to be understood once you recognize its it is based upon interacting with this sort of core typology that you find in the Gospels. And then even further into passages in the Talmud that were created by the Romans, describing their creation of the rabbinical Judaism. Going forward, you get into Pliny and Trajan and the exchange that they had, which talks about how their family, the Pisos, assassinated Domitian and then took over Christianity. And then even further, you go into the Middle Ages and to authors like Shakespeare, who were aware of this typology and based their literature upon it, so that you can't really understand the actual meaning that the authors had without knowing that they're actually relating to this typology in the Gospels. I try to focus primarily in the book on just sort of making really clear the core typology and how it relates to some of these other pieces of literature, because it's just too difficult for a reader to try to like pick up Shakespeare, you know, without having a lot of these sort of building blocks to be able to decode it with. And so it's really just an attempt to put the theory into existence and to show how it operates. Hopefully to show that there is a clear relationship between sort of government mind control and their political systems. I show that feudalism was set up by Flavius Constantine, and who also made Christianity the state religion. And in fact, Christianity was simply the mind control apparatus that was designed to fit on top of feudalism and make it impossible for the slaves to rebel, because they thought that their position in life had been divinely determined. So the new book, you know, has really two components. It just traces the typology through our literature and shows how people who were aware of it, different organizations. And then it tries to alert citizens that government has for millennium had really sophisticated techniques to rule. Ryan and I have had many exchanges, and one of the things that most concerns us is that we're sort of headed for a kind of neo-feudalism as we speak. Understanding the typology and the Roman construction of Christianity has a real meaning and value for citizens today. If you look at Christianity in the correct historical context, you can see it was perhaps just, if not the original, it was the best known false flag operation in history. It you know, claimed to be this Jewish created religion out of Judea, but
could be
in
the
fact
first possible,
it was a Roman.
Could be the first possible huge example of controlled opposition as well.
Yeah,
explain that a little bit more.
Well, many people see Christianity as you know, the New Testament, the New Covenant, that was something completely different. But it was, most scholars see it. This is Jewish literature that had some pagan elements in it, because it was in the Greco-Roman world. The Jews were getting very Hellenized, so maybe that's where the combination came from. But Joe's work is really making a strong case for it was only made to look Jewish to create a controlled opposition. So it's quite a sensational way to look at things. And when I first heard Joe, I think it was on a podcast that I first heard him speak, and I thought he was mad the first time I heard him. And the reason that is because he is offering such a new perspective, and it's so disorienting from what we've been taught that I couldn't follow what he's saying. But the more I've looked at his stuff, it sort of reminds me of back in college. We studied the novel Wide Sargasso Sea. I don't know if you've ever read that, but I never read Jane Eyre. It's actually a novel sometimes called a parallel novel that's mm-hmm. based on an older book.
Right.
So if you haven't read Jane Eyre and you read Wise or Grassless Sea, you don't really quite know what's happening, because at the end of Jane Eyre, there's a mad woman locked in the attic, and the Wide Sargasso Sea is the backstory to that. And when I first read that in college, I'd never read Jane Eyre, so I was reading that book, and the ending, it had no significance for me, because it was just, this woman goes mad, she starts this fire, and I'm just like, okay, that's an interesting ending, but I didn't get it.
Right.
So what Joe is showing is that it's a very similar kind of literature. Most scholars don't really know what genre of literature they're dealing with. So what's sometimes called parallel novels now, Joe's the sort of name in biblical scholarship, it's sort of similar, it's called typology, is you're reading texts together. I mean, sometimes it could be different books of the Bible or even passages together where you have to compare them. But in Caesar's Messiah, he's basically arguing that not just one book was written after the other, but some of the works of Josephus and the Synoptic Gospels were written at the same time because they have this intimate interplay. And, you know, and it sounds so complicated and convoluted when you first hear it. But as you sort of go step by step through Joe's work, it really has a simplicity and a lot of explanatory power that other theories don't have. Like so many other theories don't follow Occam's razor as close as Joe's work does, which means you can shave away those unnecessary assumptions, which is what Occam's razor is about, because all Joe needs is especially for his first book, Caesar's Messiah, is just those two books, just comparing those two books. And what he argues is that the Roman Caesars, they wanted to hide what they were doing, but they were also proud of it, and they wanted you to find it. So they left a trail of clues for you to find. And so that's why, as you said before, anyone can do this, is just follow the steps. And there's so much strangeness in the Bible that just no one's even offered very good explanations for what those passages mean. And Joe's been able to show that, yes, there was the author who wrote these did give it meaning, but you have to read all the texts together. And it gets very complicated in his new book, where because there's all these number threes, this theme of number three sort of with the Trinity over and over. And there's a intertextual reading between three books at the same time, so it gets very, very complicated. Especially things like Revelation with all these strange, imagery. Very few people have given satisfying explanations. I mean, it's full of such strange apocalyptic imagery that there's been just tons of interpretations put on these things. But Joe's the first one who's actually got a coherent story. So you don't get the whole story until you put all the text together. And just like I had in college with, I didn't understand the ending of Wise Sargasso Sea. Why is it significant that this woman goes mad and sets fire? It's like, because she was the character from that other story. And then when you put it together, it has a whole new meaning and it has a fuller meaning.
Oh, indeed. Now, there's a lot of things here we want to get into more detail about. We're going to tie in Shakespeare later, of course. But Joe, tell us a little bit more how you see Christianity as mind control. I mean, as the story goes, allegedly Christians were persecuted first before finally being adopted as a state religion. But at that point, I mean, in that kind of catastrophic time in the Roman Empire, they successfully managed to, topple the predecessors, the previous religious order with violence and fierce opposition. They kind of did the same thing as to what they were subjected to in the beginning. But how did it end up finally pacifying people when they adopted the religion, Joe?
You have to be careful, because there were different motivations for the religion as the Caesars faced different problems. In the first century and through the second century, the problem was the militarized messianic movement. And so in that context, the Caesars, the Flavians specifically, they weren't interested in converting zealots. They didn't think they could do that. But they wanted to slow down the missionary activity of the military messianic movement. Josephus, their court historian, just plainly states that that was something they were very afraid of. And since scholars have determined that the Jewish population of the Roman Empire was as much as 15%, and they were essentially everywhere, you can see that they didn't want, the Flavians did not want this violent anti-Roman religion to spread. And so in that context, Christianity would have been very useful politically for them. Now, when it becomes a state religion, which is a very long process, took about 70 years and started perhaps with the Council of Nicaea around 305, the individual who started this process was Flavius Constantine. There's no direct way to link him to the original Flavians, but I do think he's a family member, and there's some evidence of this. And in any case, he begins the process to make it the state religion, and it was a very violent process. It wasn't some sort of peaceful conversion from the paganisms to Christianity. Roman soldiers simply went and tore down the temples and forbid anyone to worship anything other than Jesus.
Yeah, that's right.
Why did he do that? It's because he was establishing the feudal system. And though Constantine gets a very positive legacy because he took us away from paganism, so-called, and into Christianity, the fact is he actually issued what are called the edicts against the coloni. And the coloni were a class of Roman citizens that would own land. They would colonize it, hence the name colonization coming from this class, that they would take wild land, convert it to agriculture. They would then own the land, and they could sell the product of the land. So this was a very potentially powerful political group. Constantine created a series of edicts against them. No longer could anyone own their own land. It had to be owned by the state or by the state's representative in the area. You couldn't change vocations. You couldn't start out as a farmer and end up as a lawyer. You had to stay put. You couldn't move physically. You had to stay on the land. Your children could be sold. They were property that was owned by the state. So none of the edicts that established the feudal system that Constantine created have anything to do with the sort of peace and love stuff that the character Jesus Christ is seemingly talking about in the Gospels.
Right.
And it makes no sense that he would convert to Christianity and then in one day and then set up the feudal system in the other. it's only once you've looked at the hierarchical structure of power in the feudal system, and then you can see everything is clear.
Was it a long-term plan then, basically, to enforce it?
Yeah, it was long-term plan, and the idea was they would create a religious context for slavery, whereby instead of Caesar using his title Caesar, he would just use another title, that of Pontiff Maximus, which the Caesars had used for hundreds of years and just means head of the Roman College of Priests. But once the Pope was established, instead of Caesar on the top of the hierarchy, and in between the generals were bishops and cardinals, and in between the magistrates were priests, then suddenly the serf could not rebel against the state, because to do so would be to rebel against God. And this was really the obvious goal of the imperial cult. The imperial cult was the largest bureaucracy in the Roman Empire. It existed for hundreds of years, but it didn't quite work. You just couldn't quite get the peasants to believe that Augustus or Caligula, any of these characters, were actually gods. So they just created a different story, one that had this character, Jesus Christ, and they made his representative on earth have the power of the Caesar. So if you look at the edicts of the coloni, the edicts that Constantine created to begin the feudal system, and you look at his conversion of the Roman religions to Christianity, if you just simply look at them as a collection that ends up controlling and enslaving Europe for over 1,000 years, I just honestly don't believe there's any way that a normal person can come to any of the conclusion but that Christianity was a mind control device that Constantine used to get the feudal system to have a religious context.
Wow.
I don't want to say that all Christianity is negative or bad, and the message of peace and love, I think, is all positive. But I do think the problem is worshiping the books or just the belief that God writes books, which he does, and as soon as you accept that, you're worshiping a book instead of God. And because the Bible has so many contradictions, you're kind of left with the state of mind described in 1984 as doublethink, of keeping contradictory ideas in your mind at the same time and not having any cognitive dissonance over it. See, cognitive dissonance is a very good thing. It's something that keeps you sane and safe. As soon as you shut that off, you leave yourself open to be mind controlled. And that was definitely part of that is in Christianity. It was about peace. There's positive and civilizing things about that, of course, because the Romans thought they were justified in trying to get control of rebellious Jews and assimilate them into the empire. But that has a flip side as well. You can tell someone that, well, you have to be peaceful. You have to forgive even when you're being attacked. You know, even when you're messing with your mind and trying to shut off that cognitive dissonance, which everyone needs to survive.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, when you talked about this as well, Joe, basically so much of the Roman Empire is about centralized planning, that the power of the state apparatus is to run all the aspects of daily life, you know, from the transportation of grain to, I mean, I think it was even, wasn't it Trajan, however you pronounce that. Yeah, Trajan, yeah. Who actually set up a social welfare, you know, policies.
Sure. Right. Well, Rome is a prison of nations. They have conquered dozens of ethnicities and tribes. And so they need unifying principles just to keep everyone static and to keep them from constantly rebelling. The imperial cult and Pax Romana didn't really work very well. It certainly didn't work with the Messianic Jews, but it didn't work in a lot of other cases as well. So this conversion to Christianity and establishing it as a state religion, it's an obvious attempt to just, as Ryan said, to essentially get into the minds of the simple peasants. And bear in mind at this point, there are no other ideas in circulation. Rome controls the roads. They control the literature. You find the Gnostic Gospels and eventually even the Dead Sea Scrolls, but you find those literatures buried in pots, in caves that have been covered over 10 feet in the ground. I mean, Rome made a clear effort to get rid of all of the ideas that could create independent thinking.
Total mass media control at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so today when, you know, we look at the media control that government has, in my opinion, we need to have the skepticism of a citizenry that has a history of being slaughtered by the activity of government. And oftentimes, if you look at these governments closely, it becomes very suspicious as to what the actual motive was in back of all of the things that get us into the war. I'm just very depressed. Well, not depressed, but it's just upsetting that you have, you know, McNamara's deathbed confession regarding the Gulf of Tonkin, that it was a false flag episode. You know, when you think of all of the, you know, hundreds of thousands of casualties out of that war, it's just beyond belief that these sorts of devices were used to create the political will in the population so they wouldn't rebel but would stay obedient. Then going back just a few years to World War I, you look at these people who are standing across the battlefield from one another. They don't even understand the political basis for the conflict, and yet they're walking into automatic weapon fire.
Yeah.
And Europe has this Holocaust, a real Holocaust, whereby, you know, whatever the number was, 40 million or something, I think if you include everyone who starved and whatnot, gets slaughtered in the First World War. Well, what was in back of all that? You know, I mean, it's these questions come up when you look at Christianity being a mind control device for enslaving populations by the government. You know, once you start picking away at this false flag, religious, all of these different concepts that have been sold to the peasants and to the European individual for so long, you just have to look at everything within this broader context.
Well, I mean, we've seen this pattern so many times before as well, you know, but it comes again, it echoes in socialism, in communism. We have further murders going on there of the Russian people in incredible amounts and incredible numbers. And to, again, making the state into the God figure. I mean, I see this clearly today in maybe it's more, I mean, it's more covert than that in a sense, but the fact is that the state is still out to portray itself as being, you know, the one that makes the sun go up in the morning, basically being God, you know?
Yep, exactly. In the United States, we have a kind of worship of militarism, whereby at every sporting event, they now have a military brigade
that comes out with the
flag, and you have this huge ceremony. Well, this didn't exist 30, 40 years ago. Why are they doing it now in this period where we're having these chronic and unpopular and seemingly insane wars, one after another? I mean, something as simple as that should be looked at by the citizens in a skeptical light.
Yeah.
Take the idea that many Americans don't believe they have a ruling class, that they're a classless society.
I mean, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Those kinds of ideas that, that sort of switches off certain thoughts, and you're not able to question your government in the right way, because if you don't think there's a ruling class, that everyone's really invited into that class, they work hard, and you're in trouble.
Indeed. Now, there are so many, you know, political ideologies that are fighting with each other, but at the same time, it seems like the world is also at the same time kind of moving in the same direction. So, you know, despite there being infighting, despite there being, you know, petty fights going on within the hierarchy, if you will, it seems that it's still pretty centralized pushed and we're heading in a certain direction. I mean, just see how the situation with Syria is developing right now, for instance.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, it's just odd, isn't it, that no matter how sophisticated we become, we can just never quite seem to develop the diplomacy to head off being slaughtered like animals. It's just amazing, isn't it? You know, all this technology and science, and here we are, you know, as we speak, with the Syrian situation just about to blow up. It just strikes me as requiring an explanation. I think that the skeptical citizen needs to step in here and start asking more fundamental questions regarding who the people are that are ruling us and what are their possible motivations. And I was asked this question on another show about, well, what would you have told the Christians and the feudal system, that what information would you have given them that could have been useful? And I said, you know, what I would have told them is that if you had DNA testing, which of course they didn't, but we do currently, I would have said, you know, you really should test all the bishops and the generals and just see if they're a big family. Just see if, in fact, what appears to be a legitimate religion and perhaps a legitimate political system that has different groups inside it with different kinds of political ideas, let's just test that. Let's just see who the people really are. And had they done that, they would have found that, in fact, all of the bishops were the same as all of the generals. They were all related to this patrician family class that was, in fact, ruling them with these lifetime actors that they would put a bishop or, you know, call St. Ambrose or St. Augustine or some ludicrous individual who would be, they would give this holy moniker to, probably had just died or was in this, you know, croaking end, and that this would somehow become justification that, you know, these are really sincere Christians and they really are, you know, worshiping Jesus. And even though we have to sit here like slaves and give them all of our food and they sell our children, it's really a very sincere system somehow. There's some actual reality to it relative to the ideas we're being told.
Yeah.
Well, if they just did that little test, they would have found out that it's like just complete nonsense. And I believe that the alert citizens of our era would be very well advised to do the same thing. Who the heck are these people that are just every day failing at basic diplomacy at a time when, the Western world is about to go bankrupt, right?
Yeah.
And yet we're engaging in moral crusades and perpetuating war in the Middle East. This is suspicious to me, Henrik. And I would really like to, I think the citizens deserve, and of course, you know, I could be wrong, but I think this would be like just a radical and wonderful first step. Let's just see what the relationships in fact are between these individuals who have come forward as rulers, you know? I mean, wouldn't it be amazing if, Merkel was related to, you know, the Italian prime minister? See, the details like this would create, if that was in fact true, then you would have, a radical sort of tool to be able to understand that, you know, this is that everything that you're being told is just a mind control device. And in fact, you are enslaved, you see.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be too tough to do, wouldn't cost a lot of money. And if I'm wrong, great. If not, then the citizens would have a way to know exactly what's happening to them. And suddenly they would have an amazing explanation for all of these just endless failures in diplomacy.
This is, of course, a little brotherhood here, or it might not be that little, actually, if you think about how far back it goes and then how many people that would consequently be today. But there are ideological allegiances to this as well, correct? Not only DNA or genes.
Sure, of course. I mean, if you just look at the feudal system, you can see that, there would have been a kind of almost quasi-religious background to it. It simply was the same one that the imperial cult had. In our current situation, I think that that group has long since vanished from history, or at least has no impact, and we have to look for other sorts of religious brotherhoods to flesh out the thesis. But I think that you would be able, with very, very simple genetic testing, to get an idea if this was really worth pursuing as an idea. I know that there have been some tests done on the family of Adolf Hitler, and I would really like to see some kind of comparison between his descendants and, say, Churchill and Roosevelt, because I'm really at the point where I just see history very skeptically. My experience with Christianity as a thought control device of the feudal era has left me in a troubled state, and so I would really like to have some evidence that we're not really dealing with another larger organization that is secret, that keeps its agenda hidden from the population, and has slavery and eventually population eradication as its real goal.
Yeah. They are using, I mean, as you described this as well, and they're using their own family members and also in some circumstances sacrificing them to ultimately lead and control the larger populations of nations, if we look at back, you know, past in the historical, but now, you know, basically the globe, the international sphere, if you will.
Of course. You know, if they want world domination, you know, they're prepared to accept some casualties, even among their own family members, I'm sure. It's just that the concept is so fantastic to an ordinary citizen because you're trained in the belief of history. And history is all about the dialectic. You know, this side fights against that side, and therefore the sides had some antagonism that's innate or developed between them. But the problem that I have is that when you look at the ruling class in the feudal system, where you are supposedly having these different elements within it, what you really just see is this family. And so this seems to be just a natural way of explaining our some of the just seemingly incoherent aspects of our recent history.
One of the objections to Joe's work is, well, didn't the Romans, weren't they persecuting Christians? And so in Joe's book, he shows that the first pope that we know of in history was, I think it was Vespasian's great nephew. One of the first Christian martyrs was Vespasian's, another great nephew. The first Christian catacombs that, again, enters history because there's an inscription on it, that was Vespasian's granddaughter. So it just goes on and on how many family members we have in that were supposed to, they're supposed to be enemies, the Romans and the first Christians are supposed to be enemies, but we've...
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And you see, and this just shows you how miserable the general scholarship has been up to this point in terms of Christianity, in terms of general history, because the Catholic Church recognizes that all of the first saints that has any historical foundation are members of the Flavian family. They name them the Christian Flavii, right? Because there were so many of them and they're all in this from this one family. And when you look at the Gospels and the prophecies in the Synoptic Gospels concerning the coming of the Son of Man, if you look at this individual who's going to be coming in 40 years, and there's going to be, you know, these events that are Flavian military victories, the crushing of the Galilean towns, the encircling of Jerusalem, the raising of the temple, this is all known as Flavian military victories. And then you come to the Christian Flavii. Well, isn't just the most natural question imaginable to say, well, wouldn't have this group seen the Son of Man that Jesus is predicting who does all this stuff as Uncle Titus, right? I mean, how could they have had any other understanding than that the Son of Man that Jesus predicts who does all of these military victories have any other identity than Titus, especially since he claimed to be the Jewish Christ, right?
Yeah.
So these just concrete elements and facts have somehow never been assembled and presented to the public by Christian scholarship. Why not?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You're right. I mean, and that's pretty amazing. We take so much things at face value, but as you talk about this as well, Joseph, it's obvious that this is how they've created a form of royalty. I mean, I think that this is probably how it went down in Europe, you know, during that time as well. There isn't really such a thing as a, you know, a special bloodline, if you will, but you create the appearance of such. And it's also a kind of a, well, it's a mafia mentality, la familia, right? You keep it in the family, like a true Sicilian or in Italian tradition, correct?
Sure. And I would just withhold judgment on what is the actual family relationship of the ruling class until after we've got the evidence. I really do believe that we'll find just extraordinary family connections between them, because I think that they have to maintain silence, obviously. This has to be, you know, there has to be some method by which they keep everyone quiet that knows about the ruling agenda. And I think that this would be almost impossible to achieve through money. So it has to be some kind of perhaps a religious brotherhood might be involved in it, where there is ethnicity and religion and these kinds of things, which are the supporting apparatus to keep the silence maintained, because these individuals would see a greater purpose than just, you know, wealth. The Caesars, I think, had such a kind of theology concerning themselves, of course, as human gods. So, as far as, what is the nature of the current ruling class? Well, Henrik, let's get the data. We can do it. And I just think that it wouldn't be too tough. It would sure, I think, be a wonderful thing for citizens to see if, in fact, there was just too close a family connection among all these individuals. Because, you know, we've got to come up with something, and something quick, in order to stop this process by which the wars are just never ending. If this, in fact, turned out to be the case, and even if it isn't some kind of, you know, religious brotherhood, it's just a loosely connected family that shares some sort of basis of loving power, even if it's simply closer than just normal, everyday, you know, Europeans and African-Americans, however you want to describe it, so what? At least it would be a starting point. At least we would start to know and be skeptical about where these politicians are coming from. Just oddball things, you know, George Bush Jr. and John Kerry, both coming from this organization, the Skull and Bones at Yale. Now, this is just completely improbable. Now, I would just be curious to know if there's some sort of, family structure that may be lurking there. That's part of all that.
Well, it is. I mean, I need to say it at this point. There is one publication, Burke's Peerage, that actually releases information about this, and it's been coming out, you know, many times during the collection. But it basically shows, you know, how the royal red carpet basically is a path to the White House. It shows all these connections between, you know, the Bushes and Kerry. Even though they're running there in 2004, they were distant cousins. They're related to, you know, Vlad the Impaler. They're related to Queen Elizabeth. I mean, this is out there. I don't know how much you've looked into this,
I've
Joseph.
I've looked into it a bit, and yeah. I think it's a great start, and I think that we should know the precise family connections among all of our so-called political class.
Well, exactly, because if there is, you know, such a thing, and the question is how I wonder how much they are, shall we say, interested in this, because I think that they are very interested in this themselves, to watch their own lineage and to cherry pick the people who are part of this family, if you will.
Of course, but the question is how is this related to the genocide of the European that occurred in the 20th century?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you look at the 20th century, I get different numbers when I try to actually determine. I mean, but it was somewhere between 120 and 200 million Europeans were killed.
No biggie.
it was the century of the European Holocaust,
yep.
And I would like to have some clarity as to the family structure of all of the politicians that were involved in that. I feel that as a people, we're entitled to know that information. So it's possible to be done, and if, in fact, it turns out that we are dealing with a particular group, then we would know what to do at that point, I believe.
A couple of more things I want to add there, but I want to ask if you, Ryan, have anything to kind of put in here as well, and some input on this.
Well, I would add to that is understanding psychopathy. And this is with, when we get into the Bible as... you know, there's debates. Is religion a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it civilizing? Has it wrecked civilization? I think it really depends on what people project. I mean, what's in the Bible, but also what people project on the Bible. I mean, if you're a good person, you tend to focus on the good moral aspects that are in the Bible, and you admire those, and maybe even that awakens some of your own moral intuition. But there's also clearly parts of the Bible that are psychopathic, that are, you know, a God who promotes genocide and killing children. And so I think this religious brotherhood, which has been around a long time, that's the parts of the Bible that they revere and they resonate with. They're already psychopaths, and they resonate with those psychopathic parts of the Bible. And if they believe that it's also divine and it's the Word of God, well, you've got a pretty explosive combination. And I think that's partly what the Romans encountered. So I have a little bit of sympathy for the Romans for the problem they had, but I think they were arrogant, that they think they could control it with again, black propaganda and tricks and deception and lies.
Yeah.
But that's a big piece of the puzzle. So what Joe says is looking to see what the genealogy is. You know, is this idea of democracy an illusion? Because, you know, there's all this nepotism going on, and these people are all cousins and family relations. But also, we have an image from Hollywood and movies of what a psychopath is. We think of them as a wild-eyed axe killer, and we think from films that we'd recognize psychopaths. You know, what a psychopath is they don't have a conscience. They don't have a soul. And this is something that regular people have a hard time understanding. They think it's illogical and unreasonable for people to think and behave this way. It's hard for them to understand what it's like to have no conscience to stop you from doing certain things. And these are people free of conscience. And they seem to, again, just to use religious language, they seem to need the souls of others. They're consciousness vampires of some kind. And, you know, this gets very metaphysical and everything, but this is, you know, these are people that they look and sound like regular human beings, but in some of the ways how we define human beings, they even seem like they could be a species. There's something missing from them, and it doesn't seem like they have brain damage, at least from my understanding. It's just they're not using parts of their brain, they're not using parts of their heart. And
what do you think has created some of these properties? Why is this? How does this arise? It's a very difficult question, of course. We're all wondering this, but do you have any thoughts on it?
Well, I think there are scientists thinking, you know, is this some kind of brain damage, some kind of trauma? But it does seem to, that doesn't seem to be the case. It just seems like people are born this way, and they have predatory behavior, you know, like a pack of wolves, really. And, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to say, I remember this, I think it was an article from 2009 coming out of FIS.org, basically that talked about brain difference in psychopaths, and that they had done some research on it and basically come to a conclusion. Then I will have to go through it here as we do it, but they did some you know, MRIs and stuff like that, and basically said that there are differences in the amygdala and some other areas of the brain. Now, how that research has progressed from that point, or if it's been, you know, countered, I do not know, but there could be something there. That's all I'm saying.
Well, definitely the activity in the brain is different. So some of the tests they do is to show a series of images. They'll throw in some disturbing images and some psychological tests. That psychopath's brain doesn't change. It doesn't react. And this is one of the tests sometimes used to determine, you know, is this person a psychopath. I recommend people see, there's a movie called, relatively recent movie called Imposter, that even though they don't use the word in the film, I think that is a sort of character sketch of a real psychopath. He's a guy who convinced a family that he was their long lost son, even though he was a different race, a different age. Again, he somehow convinced them, and because a lot of psychopaths are very charming, and prey on people's compassion and you know, empathic emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I'd recommend that movie for a documentary that shows you, without sensationalism, just what a regular psychopath is. you know, usually you find that you look into their past and they, you know, they keep changing identities because they basically screw people over and they have to move on to this identity. Mm. And you kind of find some of that psychology going all the way back in the Bible, the Old Testament. It's confusion over the identity of who are the Israelites? Who are the Jews? Because it's very confusing. It seems to be this morphic thing where you know, Israel was a northern tribe and Judah was a southern tribe. And they were surrounded by all these empires and they sort of got kicked around a lot. And eventually the northern tribe of Israel was taken away by the Assyrians. And then the Judeans went off to Babylon. And these people are still Jews because they've... it's hard to say. To me, it's almost like there's a psychopathic side to the Hebrew Bible that was put there, and then this has just sort of attracted other psychopaths, and then they start to call themselves Jews, even though yes, I think there's been different times when, because they had this racial philosophy of a kind of master race, that grabbed hold of a group of psychopaths, they would start to just keep it within a small tribe. And but to me, it looks like it's moved from race to race. And
go over to you a second here, Joe. How do we link that to the Roman Empire and the Flavians?
Well, you had a tremendous struggle that took place between the Flavians and a Messianic movement. And the struggle was essentially over who would be able to be the living God on the planet. I mean, the Hebrew concept was much more nuanced, but definitely there was a divine connection to their ruling leader. I mean, David had this, you know, the original Messiah had this connection with God that enabled him to, you know, kill Goliath and lead the Israelites to victory. And the Flavians also believed that they were divine. At least that's what they told people. And so I think that this really, the first century struggle established the context of the of the battle line that has existed as we go forward. And you have in the Hebrew Bible passages which can easily be used to maintain this ferocity, you know, this hatred that was established in the first century. And of course, the Christian Bible has anti-Semitism built into it. It's designed to, even though it purports to be written by Jews, it's designed to make people hate Jews. I mean, in the Bible, the Jews crucify Christ and cry out that his blood will be on our hands and on our children's hands. You see?
Yeah.
So the literature that has been given to us, right, the Bible, which has the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, is just fundamental to warfare, and that's where the literature comes from, and that's what it's designed to do. And so, right. And so when you see things in the Hebrew Bible, like Psalm 137, you know, which talks about memory serves, you know, the day Jerusalem fell, and they were all crying out, "Tear it down," and that. You know, happy is the person who repays the Gentile by seizing the Gentile infants and dashing them against the rocks. That's Psalm 137. That's just an example of the kind of literature that was used on the other side, as Ryan said, to connect to the worst impulses, the psychopathic impulses that people had. The hatred is frozen in time. The Romans froze the hatred they had against the Jews in time with their literature, and the Hebrew Bible does the same thing. So a basic manhole within our civilization has been the Bible, because it's very unfortunate, but both ethnicities, the Jew and the Gentile, can fall through the holes created in it into a very dark place. And hopefully, if the analysis in Caesar's Messiah becomes widely understood, the influence that the whole Bible has will be diminished, because you have the anti-Semitic half of it, but you also have the side of it that comes from the proponents of Israelite genocide of Gentiles. I mean, this book, the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, it's just been a catastrophe. And it may not be the only problem. I think we have a lot of problems, but I think it has been the major problem as far as organizing really a sustainable civilization. And I think that when you get all the way to the bottom of the truth, right, you get right to understand, you know, who are the ruling individuals and what is the agenda, you're going to find the Bible. It will still be with us, even as the citizens go through the process all the way to the end. The book now seems to have so little impact, you know, as you walk around European towns or American, you know, there's some, you see influence, but I'm afraid within the ruling class, the Bible still has that, the power to affect the psychopathic behavior. And how it's being used, you know, I don't know for certain, but I do know that it's in there somewhere. And I think that the faster we're able to sort of understand who we're dealing with in terms of our ruling elite, the better.
I have so many more questions that I want to ask about that in terms of, you know, basically going back and how you see that this has developed through history. Want to ask you more about modern conflict as well, because I see, and we talked recently with William Engdahl about this, how also other groups have been tied into this conflict. He explained how radical Islam today has been ramped up as yet another group of controlled opposition. And obviously we have this major conflict of the Middle East, of the Muslims and the Israelites and their conflict, how that's been taken, you know, as, you know, the center stage of the world's, you know, biggest problem, basically. And everyone is supposed to be, you know, caught up in that, basically. So there's a lot of, you know, elements here that we need to tie in. But I think we should spend some time here before we wrap things up with the first segment to talk about the upcoming event here in October, Ryan, and kind of give the details to people who want to attend. Maybe you can explain, you know, who's coming there and some of the intentions behind it, if you will, Ryan. So please go ahead and do that.
Yes, we're having a conference here in London. It's on the 19th of October, 2013. So please go to covertmessiah.com to get details for that. And what we're going to be doing there is to present the subject and go deeper. We're going to have two speakers there. Joe Atwell is coming from Santa Barbara over to London. So that'll be an opportunity for people to ask direct questions to Joe. And also Kenneth Humphreys will be there. He's the author of Jesus Never Existed. So it's going to be a great symposium. We're going to lay out the thesis and Joe's going to show some of his new work as well. And we're also going to have a screening of Caesar's Messiah, the documentary by Fritz Heed.
Yeah.
Kick off the conference with that, because just it's an excellent documentary that really gives you the context, especially the history of the first century, that really helps make sense of the work.
Very good. So this is Saturday, October 19th, of course, this year, 2013, at Conway Hall in London. And you can find much more at covertmessiah.com. By the way, there's the main image. I really like that one on the website. It's kind of like an exploded diagram, if you will, of the of the crucifix with Jesus on it. Who did that one? That's a really good one.
Yeah, I did that.
That's a really good one. I like that. That's a cool one. Let's switch over to you then, Joseph, and just ask you about your website. Of course, we've talked about your work in the past, and our audience will, you know, be aware of some of that. But please tell us the titles that you do have available on your website, and also the progression, if you will, of the new book that you're working on, Joseph.
Right. If you're interested in getting Caesar's Messiah, the book or the documentary, you can just go to caesarsmessiah.com. They're available there in different formats. And at the event, in London will be releasing the new book, The Single Strand. And so that literature will be available for people who come to the show. We're hoping to really bring the idea of Christianity as government mind control into, you know, a sharp public focus at the seminar. We're hopefully will attract some media attention so that this idea, which we believe is useful, will be given to people at at a time when the citizens need all the information they can get their hands on to be able to make sense of our reality.
All right, very good. Caesarsmessiah.com, of course, Flavian's Signature, the first book in the series, if you will, and then the follow-up, The Single Strand, coming later. So do check that out in covertmessiah.com as well. All right, gentlemen, stay with us. We'll proceed here in the next segment. Much more to talk about. We'll be right back after this break.
Lions in the street and roaming, dogs in heat, rabid foaming, a beast caged in the heart of the city. The body of his mother rotting in the summer ground, he fled the town. He went down south and crossed the border, left the chaos and disorder back there over his shoulder. One morning he awoke in a green hotel with a strange creature groaning beside him. Sweat oozed from its shiny skin. Is everybody in? Is everybody in? Is everybody in? The ceremony is about to begin. Wake up! You can't remember where it was. Had this dream stopped? The snake was pale gold, glazed and shrunken. We were afraid to touch it. The sheets were hot, dead prison. And she was beside me. Oh, she's no young. Her dark white hair, the white soft skin. Now run to the mirror in the bathroom, look. Coming in here, I can't live through each slow century of her moving. I let my cheeks slide down the cool, smooth tile. Feel the good cold, stinging blood. The smooth hissing. Once I had a little game, I liked to crawl back in my brain. I think you know the game I mean. I mean the game called Go Insane. You should try this little game. Just close your eyes, forget your name, forget the world, forget the people, and we'll erect a different steeple. This little game is fun to do. Just close your eyes, no way to lose. labyrinth of streams beneath, the quiet unearthly presence of gentle hill people in the gentle hills around. Reptiles abounding, fossils, caves, cool air heights. Each house repeats a against morning. Rug silent, mirrors vacant, dust blind under the beds of lawful couples, wound in sheets, and daughters smug with semen, eyes in their nipples. There's been a slaughter here. Don't stop to speak or look around. Your gloves and fan are on the ground. You're getting out of town. You're going on the run. And you're the one I want to come. I am the Lizard King. Retire now to your tents and to your dreams. Tomorrow we enter the town of my birth. I want to be ready.
In our second hour, we continue our discussion and proceed to outline the conflict, whom the players are, and the nature of this war. We bring in some very fascinating elements into the discussion as well, like the sexual revolution of the 60s, the MK Ultra background to the drug cults, and some of the updated Christian literature as well. We discuss technology, neo-feudalism, and the nature of the playpen that we've been given, and how this has shaped our minds, our thought process, and the concepts of history. And also, more shockingly, I think, we finish on Shakespeare. You have to hear this part. Who is the author? Why did she write it? Why is it written the way it is? Why is it promoted? And why is it that this has been laid out as the literary foundation of the Western world? It's a continuation of the drama playing out over thousands of years, and on such a long-term battle plan, it is almost too large of a cycle for most people to comprehend. When you're ready for more, you can continue to listen at redicemembers.com. If you do not have a subscription already, you can sign up right there on the website. We have all the information for you right there. It's quick, it's easy, and you get instant access to our archives from 2006 up till today and all the new material that is coming in on a regular basis. So do not miss the second hour. Good stuff is coming up. Thank you for listening and for your interest. We'll talk to you on the other side.